Hi there, welcome to Series 2 of Wolf Cub Film Club. On this episode, Dad and I are taking a look at the recently released doco, Still, a Michael J. Fox movie. We had an in-depth chat about the filmmaking side of things, in particular the use of existing and newly shot dramatic footage as a narrative tool. We also touched a little bit on our own experiences with Essential Tremors. Michael J. Fox's struggle with Parkinson's disease is obviously a big part of this story. There is a link to the Michael J. Fox Foundation in the show description, as we believe it's a very important cause. Dad and I would also like to dedicate this episode to our dear friend Mac Gudgeon. Mac was a renowned Australian screenwriter and a great guy who recently, sadly, passed away. All right, guys, enjoy this one.
All right, do you want to kick off then?
Yeah, I'll kick it off with a concise intro. So today, guys, we're looking at the documentary Still, a Michael J. Fox movie. It's directed by Davis Guggenheim, who also did The Inconvenient Truth. And it explores the private and professional life of actor Michael J. Fox, and in particular, his battle with Parkinson's disease. It's on Apple TV Plus. It just came out this month. And we warn you guys, there's plenty of spoilers.
Oh, yes, there were big plenty of spoilers, as there usually is.
Yeah, so I enjoyed this film. It was entertaining. I really enjoyed the positivity of Michael J. Fox. His defiant and self-effacing attitude was really, he was quite uplifting. It wasn't a doom and gloom story. It was quite entertaining, and I really just enjoyed the positivity of it. From a filmmaking perspective, I think it was pretty cool the use of all the dramatic footage he had from his films that they integrated into the storytelling. And looking at some of the other docos we've looked at, like for instance, Amy was all archival footage. Stories We Tell was archival footage reenacted. And in this one, it's essentially just all the footage from his films and projects used to articulate his story and moments in his life, which I found pretty cool.
Yeah, it's done very cleverly, because the archive is used as a kind of parallel storytelling device. So if Michael J. Fox is talking about how he first got started in show business and he couldn't earn a living, there would be this parallel bit of footage from one of his movies or Family Ties where he's trying to get a pay rise out of the boss. So they really cleverly use the archive not just as wallpaper, but as kind of illustrative and parallel to all the stories that he's telling. And I thought that really took it up a notch for me.
Yeah, it was classic, the range of stuff they had for any given moment. They could draw on a scene from Family Ties or his films and just have it right there. I haven't seen that done before, really.
No, not so cleverly or maybe deliberately. Another example, like they mixed them up as well. So I remember there's a shot of him in Back to the Future looking at an old newspaper from back in time, and it cuts to a newspaper close-up of the top 10 movies in America, and Back to the Future is number one. So they've used the archive, and then they've cut to a contemporary newspaper to keep telling the story. So yeah, it's really quite clever, and they do that throughout the film. When he's falling in love with his wife, Tracy. There's a parallel story in Family Ties because she was an actress in that series who he fell in love with in the series. So they use the archive from Family Ties in the telling of the story, including the first kiss, you know, which is really quite clever. I mean, fortuitous, because I don't suppose he's the first actor to fall in love with his leading lady, but it's fortuitous that they've got that footage.
In that footage, you can see this understated thing between them. You get a sense of that, which is pretty cool because they're obviously just playing out the sitcom, but you get a sense of this underlying relationship that's starting to grow.
But yeah. I think in your introduction, just to step back a bit, you raised two or three issues, one of which is it's advertised on Netflix as still a Michael J. Fox movie. And that made me think, well, I assumed that Michael J. Fox was a producer or an executive producer. But throughout the credits, there is no mention of Michael J. Fox being part of the filmmaking team. So I reckon the Michael J. Fox movie bit has just been, and it's not on the title either. When the title comes up on the screen, it just says still. So I think Netflix have added that on as a kind of promo thing because they want people to know it's a film about Michael J. Fox. So they've called it a Michael J. Fox movie, but it's not a Michael J. Fox movie. He's not involved at all, as far as I can tell.
On IMDb, it actually credits him as the writer.
Well, that's interesting too, because in the final credits, it says that the film is based on books written by Michael J. Fox. So, you know, I haven't read any of his books, but I Googled them. And he's written two or three memoirs, largely from the perspective of dealing with Parkinson's disease. And I think it's quite clear, because we see it in the film, that he's reading excerpts from his books as a way of telling his story. So I don't know if you remember that scene. Well, a couple of times you see him reading to a microphone with a producer or a woman kind of prompting him. And at first I thought, oh, they've written narration for him. But I reckon that he was reading from his books.
Yeah, I remember him reading a passage about his father directly from the book.
Yeah, that's one of my two big moments in the film, because he's reading about the death of his father. And although he's written this and he's reading it, he kind of breaks down. He can't read it. It's too hard. The raw emotion of his father's death sort of comes back and haunts him. So I think that's why you've got that credit written by Michael J. Fox. The film actually it's a combination, isn't it? There's archive, as you mentioned, but there's also reconstructions, dramatic reconstructions, and they're all credited at the end of the film. So there's him as a little boy and some guy playing his father and someone playing his mother and so on. So you've got these reconstructions, which are fairly conventional, but they're done like a feature film. And when you look at it's huge credits. Credits go for about 5-10 minutes. There's crews and there's gaffers and there's all the people that doco makers generally either don't use or can't afford to use. So that there are these well-done dramatic reconstructions. There's the archive, and then those are knitted together with observational documentary moments of his current life. So you see his actual struggle with Parkinson's disease. And those three elements, the archive, the reconstruction, the op-doc footage, is knitted together by his narration. And I think, again, it's a good idea because he's obviously honed his writing. I mean, he's got a knack of saying things as one-liners, which are very, very powerful. Right at the beginning, because the intro sets up the film that he's got Parkinson's, the auto-animated pinky, that was the first sign of Parkinson's disease, was that his little finger started moving involuntarily, and they recreate that dramatically. But it's set up at the beginning that he's got Parkinson's, and then it sort of goes back to his childhood and tells his story chronologically from then on. And every now and then they move back into the present and we see him with his life coach or his physiotherapist or his doctor or his family actually kind of dealing with the disease today. So it's a pretty fine editing job, I think.
Yeah, and it's kind of in two halves. It's his massive success followed by coming to terms with this incurable diagnosis. And it's got a bit of hero's journey to it in a way.
Not in a way. It is the hero's journey.
It is once again the hero's journey. You're right. In the fact that it's really about him initially feeling invincible because of his success and feeling almost superhuman in a way. And how can this possibly, he said it himself, he's like, this can't happen to me. I'm infallible. And then him going through this process of denial, which led to some alcoholism and things, and then eventually stepping toward taking ownership of the illness and coming out in public, and all the fear behind, you know, is this the end of his career and his persona and who he is? But actually the ultimate embracement of it and stepping into it was how he defiantly took ownership of it. And I just found it fascinating in the acting side of things when he was trying to deny it, but his left arm was getting more and more uncontrollable, so he was keeping his left arm busy in the Spin City series, which was late in his career. I just found that fascinating how he was trying to keep a lid on this thing till he no longer could, and then he just had to front up to it. But he maintained his humor and his acceptance of it, and then really stepped into that later part of his career and life. I found that struggle with it really fascinating.
So then what is the turning point in the hero's journey?
The first turning point is, denial. Is it denial? Or what's the, is it the inciting incident or what is it?
Well, that's what dramatists call the inciting incident. But in terms of the hero's journey, remember, the hero's journey is you've got someone who's going along in life and doing fine. And then he is called into a new world to fight a new battle, as it were. He's taken completely out of his comfort zone and sent on a new quest. So the turning point for Michael J. Fox is
the diagnosis.
When he's diagnosed.
Yeah, it's the diagnosis.
And that happens around the time that his father died. So it's like a double whammy.
He's diagnosed at 29 years old, which is very young for Parkinson's.
Yeah.
Extraordinarily young. And I don't know what you think, but he made a comment which I found, like you said, his power with words or these one-liners. I don't remember the exact line, but he said it was as if it was a cosmic balancing. It was as if it was a cosmic shift. Because of his success, it was like the cosmic balance balancing it out.
He says, it was the cosmic price I had to pay for my success. That's his exact words.
What do you think of that statement?
Well, there's a kind of notion of fate in there, or not perhaps so much fate, but karma, that we reap what we sow, and that he's sown this wild story of success, but it's always laced with difficulty. He made Back to the Future when he was appearing in Family Ties, if you remember. So during the day, he was working on Family Ties, and during the night, he was off to the set of Back to the Future. And the success of these projects was such that he says, everywhere I looked, there was an image. I saw images of myself, but none were of the real me, whoever that is. So from the beginning, his success is taking a toll on him. He talks about being locked in a world of isolation and fear. In fact, he says later in the film, and I wrote this one down as well because I thought it was an absolute ripper, an actor's burning ambition is to spend as much time as possible pretending to be someone else. So he was acting 24 hours a day. Family Ties, you know, 9 till 5, Back to the Future from 6 till 8 or whatever. So he was avoiding himself all the while. And then when he's diagnosed with Parkinson's, as you said, he continues that denial and tries to hide for 8 years, hiding the symptoms. And it's amazing when you look at that footage, isn't it? Because you can see his hand shaking and you think, well, why didn't people pick this up? So he's precipitated into this new world where he has to face this new problem. And of course, in facing it, he reaches rock bottom. He's on the booze. He's taking tablets every 10 minutes. And it's when he hits rock bottom that with the support of his wife, he comes clean to the world. As you say, afraid that that'll be the end of his career. And of course, he gets a whole lot of very positive feedback from people. And he says, that moment, I thought it was the end, but in fact, it was the beginning. So it's clearly the hero's journey, where our hero is taken out of the world that he's used to, plonked into a completely different world of challenge where he has to face himself. And of course, he's transformed and comes out of it as a hero. So it's a perfect example of the hero's journey.
It really is. And what he was saying about hiding his real self, that was before the diagnosis. So it was the embracement of the illness that brought him back to his real self, ultimately.
He says there, you're only as sick as your secrets. And I thought that was a great line as well. That once he acknowledged his secrets about the disease suddenly becomes, he's able to confront the disease. And what does he do? Becomes a campaigner for Parkinson's, and his foundation has raised over $2 billion towards Parkinson's disease research. So you've got that kind of not a perfect ending, because they haven't cracked the cure yet. But I was going to go on to my second moment, because the second moment for me is, you know, I think the archive's great and it's very clever and the reconstructions are fantastic and really well done. But for me, the core of the film is watching him in the here and now, dealing with this increasingly debilitating disease, where, you know, he's always falling over, one part of the film, he's broken his hand, he's got pins in it, and he's got a bandage. Another part of the film, he's cracked his head on something. He's had pins put in his cheeks. You see footage of him trying to walk and falling over. He has his coach or his physiotherapist who's interestingly constantly trying to slow him down. And hence the title Still, because the overriding image of Michael J. Fox as an actor is him running, isn't it? He's always running.
He's hyper.
And he's always running places. Like Back to the Future, he's really hyper. And he says, I think towards the end of the film, I could never be still. I only became still when I was unable to be still.
That's the irony. The irony. Yeah,
it is the irony of it. But the second moment that I was thinking about is he's working with his coach and he gets quite exasperated and frustrated with his condition and he almost cries and the coach sort of says, so what are you worried about, Michael? And he said, I'm worried about the responsibility of being Michael J. Fox, that I'll fuck it up. And I think he's referring to the new Michael J. Fox, the campaigning, activist, fundraising hero. And this is the kind of new image that he's trying to live up to, and it's causing him difficulty. And the coach says to him, it's okay sometimes not to be Michael J. Fox. So that for me was a very powerful emotional moment, along with the moment of him trying to read the stuff about his dad dying. And they are both in the current day footage. So I think if you strip the film back, you've still got some amazing stuff, which is him dealing with having Parkinson's in the here and now.
Which is remarkable, again, for him to be in the condition he's in, having a 30-year battle with it. His interactions with his family are classic too. I think he says to his son, you know, I try and respond to a text and I end up on a Chinese website.
Yeah.
they've all learned to find the humor. You know, find the humor in it.
Yeah. Have you got any questions, though, about the role of the family in the film?
In what sense?
For me, in the sense that they participate in that you see scenes of Michael with his family, but they never talk to camera.
True, it's really a solo. Yeah, that's true, actually. It's all Michael J. Fox. Yeah. It's really all, you don't get the other side of the coin, really, from the other family.
I mean, he talks about them. He talks about his wife, you know, how she gave up her acting career. They had twins. He was still working 24 hours, you know, all the hours that God gave. She was at her wit's end, but he says somewhere, she's taken on my condition more than I have, in a way. So the family is obviously very supportive, but there must be a whole other story from her perspective of how, so one minute she's a trained theatrical actor and the next minute she's a housewife with twins and an absent husband.
There's another story that I'm fascinated in, actually, and that is the guy who got fired from Back to the Future, because they had another actor for a month and they weren't happy. It wasn't working. So after a month shooting, that's when they recast. But I was curious what happened to that guy,
right?
You know, I was like, that's it. That's potentially a doco in itself, because it did become the biggest movie in the world at the time. And interestingly enough, I've diverted from the family.
No, that's all right. We'll come back to them.
But yeah, they didn't play a they didn't really show that other side. But no, I coincident. Well, at the same time, I showed the Back to the Future movies to Leo, and my boy's 10, so he's obviously in the modern. He's in the time that in Back to Future, they were set to hit 2023. So it was not only interesting to show him the film purely as like a nostalgic piece of 80s entertainment, but grasping the jumping around in time. But we watched both one and two, and they still hold their own. It was just really interesting the way they dealt in the films with what the future held, that they didn't really count for the digital age. They didn't really count for the internet. So it was things like nuking a pizza and stuff like that, but it didn't really take into account how, you know, the internet was coming.
Yeah, right.
But they were very entertaining. And as we say, Michael J. Fox, he was just continuously on the go, and just this little, he's small guy, just but with a huge energy. And that was his
yeah.
thing.
Yeah. It's interesting when they're dealing with his childhood. He says, you know, he was a kid who failed to recognize boundaries. He relied on his capacity, because he was small, he was bullied, and he relied on his capacity to run away from bullies. So the running began when he was a kid, you know. He also discovered that it was much safer to make people laugh, because then they didn't get angry with you. And the third thing he learned was that drama class was where the girls are. So he was setting himself up to be the Michael J. Fox of the movies. And as he says, Hollywood saw value in a small actor who could play the part of a child or a younger person.
Yeah. Yeah, an older actor who could play children, basically.
Yeah. So he was kind of tailor-made for it, really. But going back to the family, it just made me wonder why we don't hear, say, from his wife, from Tracy, direct to camera. And it was obviously a deliberate decision. Whether it was based on modesty, or she didn't want to participate, or Michael J. Fox tries to keep his family out of, you know, the limelight and the risks of being in the limelight, or there just wasn't time. You know, it's a 90-minute film anyway. So to bring in the story of his kids or his wife would have perhaps blown it out. I don't know. I haven't really read any interviews with the director that shed any light on that. But, yeah, for me, the family are there, but they're very, you know, very goody-goody. And I can't believe that, because the scenes in the kitchen with the family and playing cards or whatever, you know, they're all happy, they're all laughing. Michael J. Fox is laughing. You know from the other footage with him that he's not laughing all the time. He's in pain, he's on medications, it must be very difficult for the family to deal with.
Yeah, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. There's a long history there of it. But yeah, who knows the intricacies of the time constraints and all that stuff. What would your preference have been to bring them in a bit more, if possible?
Yeah, I think I would have liked to have heard something. But it felt to me like it was a conscious decision. And in a way, possibly propelled by the thesis of the film. I mean, the log line is something like, what happens when an incurable optimist contracts an incurable disease? I mean, you said at the start that one of the attractions of the film for you was its positivity. And it's, you're right, but I just wonder whether we've got to stick to the optimism.
It's a common theme with a lot of the films we explore. We're like, have they gone into all the nitty gritty, what's not necessarily brought out in the open, and who hasn't had a voice in the film?
Yeah, it's true. And these are decisions, whether made by Michael J. Fox or whether made by the director, because, you know, who knows, maybe they did long interviews with Tracy. Maybe it was in the edit suite that these kinds of decisions tended to be made. But we don't know, because we weren't there in the making of the film. But the other thing about, I mean, some of the films we've discussed don't have happy endings. You know, Amy's one example. But Michael J. Fox is still going and still optimistic. And my interest in seeing the film actually was prompted by a year or two ago, he did an interview with Rob Lowe on Rob Lowe's podcast.
I listened to that, yeah.
And he talked about gratitude and how gratitude feeds optimism. That if you can find something in life to be grateful about, that feeds a sense of optimism about life. If you can't find something to be grateful for, you're likely to sort of sink into pessimism. And I thought that was really interesting. I don't know. I mean, that was during lockdown, I think I listened to that podcast of Rob Lowe's. And maybe we were all in a bit of a depressed state at the time. But it seemed to me to be an interesting little piece of philosophy. And Anne, for example, every Monday morning, she and her colleagues at the Pilates studio, they have a 15-minute get-together on Zoom where they all have to say something that they're grateful for. And I sit there and go, thank God, I haven't got to get up at up past 8 on a Monday morning and tell people what I'm grateful for. But I can see that it would have a positive effect on one's life to do that.
It's interesting you say that, because I've been trying to do that a little bit on my way. I've integrated it into my gym routine. And just on the way back from the gym here, there's a bench that I just sit on, normally grab some sun for 5 minutes. But I literally try and just do probably less than a minute of gratitude. And even without getting airy-fairy or whatever, but even with just 1 minute of it in the day, it has an effect.
Is that every day or a couple of times a week?
I found it useful to stack habits onto existing habits. And during the week when I do this gym routine, part of it, the consistency of it, is that I walk back from the gym to the apartment. And on the way back, I've just integrated this stopping and taking a few moments of gratitude.
Right.
Because after the working out and all that stuff, I think I'm in probably a better state to be able to do that. I'm not in a rush or whatever. Mm. I don't devote very long to it at all. A couple of things, it's just like just simple things, health, family, you know, and it really, there's no doubt that it has some power in it.
Yeah. Well, the other thing he discussed with Rob Lowe, which is mentioned in the film, is that Michael J. Fox does TM, Transcendental Meditation. And I found that, because, you know, I do a bit of TM, or I try to do it at least in the mornings before I get out of bed. And that, I think meditation is another way in which feelings of gratitude come through in the meditation, and I think that's been good for me.
I don't know if this is something you want to talk about, but for the listeners, both you and I have some essential tremors, and you know me, when I watch these films, I'm always looking for the relatable, and one of my biggest fears in my acting experience has been that my tremors will impact on performances and projects and things. And it actually hasn't been the case so far, but I found that very obviously essential tremors is different to Parkinson's.
It's not life threatening.
Yeah, but for me, I've always been, because predominantly in my hands, I've always been self-conscious of it, and then moving into a performing arts, even with music, playing instruments, things. It's I could just relate to, you know, is this gonna hold me back? But I, again, going back to the well-being stuff, I've found stuff that, you know, my well-being affects it directly. And the better state I am in with my well-being, that, you know, it's relative.
Yeah, well, I think you manage it very well, and I think it definitely is related to stress and how much coffee one
stimulants
drinks
and yeah,
stimulants, yeah, and stuff like that. But yeah, that the notion of concealing, and that's when an essential tremor, when it starts to prevent you socializing and leading a normal life, that's when you need to take some action. And as you know, I was at that stage where I didn't want to eat or drink with people socially. I mean, the family understand, because, you know, I'd spill my drink or I couldn't eat without my hands shaking. And medication was the first port of call. A lot of performers take beta blockers when they're nervous to steady their nerves, steady their hand. But as you know, eventually the medication couldn't continue to conceal the tremor that I had. You know, mine wasn't as bad as Michael J. Fox's. And the difference is that with Parkinson's, the tremor happens when you're at rest, whereas with an essential tremor, it only happens when you're using your muscles. So when you're at rest, you don't experience the tremor. But anyway, I had to, the next port of call, as you know, was surgical intervention. And that's helped a lot. So yeah, these kinds of, it did, there's a scene early on in this doco where Michael J. Fox is trying to brush his teeth. Do you remember it? And the toothbrush is just going everywhere. It's going 15 to the dozen. And that brought to mind the situations I've been in where it just prevents one from doing what one wants to do. So, yeah, I did relate to that aspect.
Mm. Just one quick bit of humor. I just remember at my 21st, a friend made a speech and he said, "Oh, Danny wants to be an architect. Have you seen him try and hold a pen?"
Right.
And a few people didn't really laugh at the time, but now I think that's quite a funny one-liner. But I think at the time I was a bit rattled because I was self-conscious about it. But again, it's like finding the irony and the humor in the, you know, the crafts you want to do. But yeah, just the humor, the humor side of it.
I saw the other thing that makes this film currently relevant is the passing of our friend Mac Gudgeon, who also had Parkinson's disease and died last week. Mac was a senior member of the Australian filmmaking community and a top scriptwriter, a well-known scriptwriter, and had worked on some wonderful projects and was a mentor to me in my early filmmaking career. So I thought perhaps we could dedicate this little podcast to Mac, even if only the three listeners that we have hear it.
Nah, definitely.
It'd be a nice thing.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, fond memories of camping with him as a child, and an awareness of the film community and his reputation within it.
Yeah, he was a great guy and always encouraging of other people and their work and their development.
Mm.
So Mac will be sorely missed. I think the only other thing, well, there were actually two things. One was I'd not heard of David Guggenheim, the director, until I watched this film. So, of course, then I looked him up and realised that, as you mentioned, he had directed Al Gore's film, An Inconvenient Truth, about climate change, that he produced and directed numerous other films, including It Might Get Loud. Have you seen that? It's about three guitarists, Jimmy Page, The Edge, and a guy called Jack White.
I have. Yeah, I have. I think I did. Yeah. White Stripes is Jack White. Yeah.
And so I've got that on my list to watch. But the interesting thing about David Guggenheim, and I'm assuming he's a member of the Guggenheim family, is that he's a billionaire.
Oh.
Yeah. And I thought, well, that's my ideal kind. You know, if you've got the money, I'm not saying that he finances his own films. I'm sure he gets financed without any difficulty. But if you've got enough money to fund your own projects,
living the dream.
Wouldn't that be living the dream?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Without the financial constraint.
Yeah. The other thing was just, it struck me about the continuity in the film, because Michael J. Fox's life story is told chronologically with the archive and so on. But the current day observational footage seems to jump backwards and forwards in time a bit, because in one scene he's got a bandaged hand, and then in the next scene he doesn't, and then in a scene later on the hand is bandaged again. And he's got the black eye, you know, the black eye comes and goes and the bandage comes and goes. And so you realise that the sequences that have been shot with Michael have then been cut according to what's needed for the story, rather than chronologically.
Interesting, yeah.
Continuity in documentary is a constant tricky thing. You know, with drama, you're not allowed to cross the line. People's eye directions and movements have to continue in the same direction, and they can only change direction if we actually see it on the screen. But in documentary,
anything goes.
Yeah, anything goes. You get stuff shot from opposing angles. You get people who are wearing one thing in an interview, and then in the next grab they've got something else. And I think this is true of the Michael Fox one. Later on when he appears, he's got that original T-shirt on again. But somehow you just kind of get away with it in a documentary, because the story is the argument of the film and people are following the logic of the story. And I'm not fussed about continuity.
Time.
Yeah, and time in the same way that they might be fussed in a drama. But maybe that's all about stillness as well. The film itself jumps around in time just as Back to the Future jumped around in time.
There's a few metaphors for stillness, but it's very harmonious in the theme of stillness, and that's what he's trying to get to in a way. So a lot of synchronized themes and intricacies.
Yeah. He says at the end, I mean, I think the end's a bit hackneyed personally, but he says on the soundtrack, "I couldn't be still, I couldn't be present in my life till I found this thing happen to me that made me present in every moment of my life, because it was shaking me away." So that's another of his one-liner statements. But the film ends with them all walking along the beach together, mum, dad and the kid, grown-up kids, and they're walking into the sunset. Bit hackneyed, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, no, I did.
Yeah. But then it cuts to Michael just looking into the camera for about 30 seconds, and he's still, he actually is still. And then the credits roll.
Yeah, that's cool.
But, you know, it's always hard to end a film and you want to keep the upbeat going. So they probably tried fading on the sunset and it felt really hackneyed. So, but the shot of Michael looking into the camera and being still for once, I thought was quite a nice ending.
Yeah, that's a nice ending. No, I agree.
But I think it's a great film. I really enjoyed it. And like you, I got a lot out of it in terms of... he says at the beginning, I think Guggenheim says to him, what do you think of this storyline that successful actor suffers incurable disease? And Michael says, that's a boring storyline. And that sets up the kind of purpose of the film and the impetus of the film and the focus on optimism, which he clearly is an optimistic kind of guy. And
yeah, and it's an important cause, important message.
So. Yeah, yeah. And we're trying to get together another podcast which will touch on the effects of being in some of these documentaries, because there's a film been made called Subject, which is full of people that have been in documentaries and the effect that participating in those films has had on them.
Yeah.
But I'm waiting for it to come on some streaming platform.
Yeah, especially when somebody's been cast in a particularly difficult light.
Yeah.
And then they have to suffer the consequences.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
They have to live with that. All right, mate.
Nice one, Wolf.
See you.
Till the next one.
Yep, absolutely. Okay.
Ciao. Thank you for listening. We very much appreciate any honest reviews you might like to leave on whichever podcasting platform you listen to. If you have a film you would like Wolf and I to check out, please hit us up at lionfuryproductions@gmail.com. Any questions are also welcome. And please follow us on the Instagram. Thanks again, guys. Till next time.